This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. No matter what you do, work for a large or a small company, a nonprofit, the government, or volunteer your time and services, chances are you have sat through a lot of meetings. And chances are many of them have felt like a waste of time. They take too long. They're boring. Someone dominates the discussion. If there is a discussion, it doesn't accomplish anything. A well-run meeting can accomplish many good things, but unfortunately, they tend to be the exception. Today in Radio Times, what it takes to run an effective and efficient meeting. We asked Adam Grant to join us. He's a professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times earlier this year to discuss his book called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. His research focuses on motivation, on helping behaviors, job design, leadership burnout, and meaningful work. And Adam Grant, I know you're not feeling very well, but we thank you for joining us today by telephone.
Thanks for having me, Marty. It's much better than being in a meeting.
Indeed, it is much better than being in a meeting. And why is that?
Oh, gosh. You know, I would go to Dave Barry, who said that if you had to identify in one word the reason why the human race has not achieved and never will achieve its full potential, that word would be meetings. Just a time-sapping distraction from almost everything else we care about.
But is it because the people who run the meetings don't know what they're doing, or people just sort of resent being taken away from whatever it is that they're doing and have to sit in a room for an hour?
Yeah, it turns out to be all of the above. So people hate having their time wasted. They find that most meetings are poorly organized, not well planned, and often sabotaged by the people who do show up.
And why is that? I mean, you know, you and I are talking. Meetings are a common thing. Why is it so difficult to have an efficient meeting?
Well, I think meetings start to fall apart at the very beginning because rarely do we ask, what's the purpose? Why am I actually bringing people together? One reason to have a meeting might be to actually try to improve decision quality and bring diverse perspectives together. A different reason might be to just share and disseminate information. And you could think about also the purpose of a meeting being about getting buy-in and making sure that everybody's on board with a plan or a goal or a strategy. And most of the time, we just put meetings on our calendar without sitting down to figure out, well, what is that real objective, and then how do we structure the meeting to achieve it?
There are, of course, very different kinds of meetings. There are, you know, the quarterly staff meeting that companies have. There are the meetings where you bring people together that may not know each other. There are, of course, meetings within departments where colleagues who work together come together to discuss things. Is there a kind of a one-size-fits-all for those kinds of different kinds of meetings?
I don't think so. I think the starting point for designing a good meeting is to actually figure out who's coming into the room and why, and then determining the right format for it.
And what would be a good why?
Well, I think a lot of that depends on the organization you're working in and the group of people that you're gathering. But the best why, in my opinion, is to say, this is a decision that requires the input of multiple people. And ideally, we want to make sure that each of those people has a chance to share their expertise, and the whole group can benefit from hearing different sides and ultimately reaching a better conclusion.
And is it, I mean, and I'm thinking about leaders of meetings, and, you know, true confessions here, I hold meetings, as many people do. But does it sort of put the onus on the organizer or the leader of the meeting to have an agenda, to have some clarity about what's going to be discussed during that meeting?
It does. I think that the first step to take if you're leading a meeting is to actually send out an agenda in advance. And that way people can figure out a little bit more what is the goal or the agenda for the meeting, but also then begin to plan how they might contribute. And the best part of that is that some people will actually respond to that by saying, you know, here are a bunch of things that people may want to read and prepare in advance so that we don't have to waste as much time in the meeting getting everyone up to speed.
Do you run meetings, Adam?
I try to avoid it, but I get stuck doing it about every week.
And do you dread it? I mean, I hear it in your voice. Do you dread it, as I think many people do?
I do. I've even had meetings about meetings to try to figure out why our meetings are so unpleasant and unproductive.
And that's so interesting to me, because it doesn't, I mean, you know, it's not like we're trying to crack some chemical code or something like that. It's just so curious to me that it's such a conundrum.
Well, if you think about groups of people coming together, most of the time there's a much clearer, not only agenda, but set of roles. So, you know, you work in a team and you know exactly what's expected of you. What's your contribution? When do you speak up? When do you think about focusing on a task? And I think meetings so often come together with groups of people who have never interacted before and have no idea exactly what everyone else is going to bring to the table, let alone what's expected of them.
We posted something on our Facebook page yesterday, and I'm just going to read a couple of responses. One said, I found that most meetings are unnecessary. We had several responses that said, just keep it short and simple or short and sweet, and the importance of having a concise agenda and staying on track. Do those sound like things that you have thought about and talked about, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the hard question is, how do you get to those objectives? One of my favorite steps, which a lot of organizations are moving toward now, is to hold stand-up rather than sit-down meetings. And it's pretty remarkable. There's actually a study on this by Alan Bluedorn and his colleagues where they have people meet about the same topics and they have to reach a decision. And they look at whether you're standing up during the meeting or sitting in chairs, and then they track how much time the meeting takes as well as the objective quality of the decision. Lo and behold, stand-up meetings on average are 34% shorter.
Why am I not surprised? Yes.
Yeah, but the amazing thing is decision quality doesn't suffer. So people become more concise when they're standing on their feet and getting tired, but they actually still share all the critical information that's needed to make a good decision.
So should we all have stand-up meetings?
I would be an advocate for it as long as we're not dealing with a meeting that actually requires several hours.
Right. And there are sometimes there are those meetings that do require several hours. I'm wondering even about how sort of people, if they are sitting, how they're placed around a table and the kind of dynamics that can happen around a table when there's a meeting.
Yeah, I think there's an old saying in the social sciences that the most important person in any meeting was the janitor who arranged the chairs. And I think there's a lot of truth in that statement. To recognize that where people sit is going to have a huge impact on who they look at, who they listen to, who has the easiest time getting heard. And one interesting way to get some traction on this, actually, is to follow a bit of advice from Dan Pink in his book, To Sell as Human. He recommends going through a meeting and actually mapping who talks and who they're talking to. And then you can begin to track where the attention in the meeting is getting directed and is that optimal or not.
And by talking to, it's literally who they're looking at, who they're directing their comments to?
Exactly, yeah. So you can pay attention to who they're looking at directly, and also, you know, oftentimes a meeting comment will start with, well, Marty, I wanted to respond to that particular point that you made, and if a lot of comments are getting directed at you, even if you're not the formal leader in the team, it may suggest that you're actually an opinion leader in the room.
That's Adam Grant, and we asked him to join us today in Radio Times to talk about the art of running an efficient and effective meeting. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Adam, do you think leaders of meetings talk too much?
Yeah, they do. This is something I've done research on, and what we find is especially extroverted leaders feel like when they get into a meeting, it's their job basically to run the show. And the problem with that, to borrow a comment from Jim Quigley, who used to run Deloitte, is when I'm talking, I don't learn anything. I only learn when I'm listening. And Jim actually went so far as to set a rule that he was only allowed to talk a maximum of 20% of the time in a given meeting.
And by him holding back, did that allow others to hold forth?
It did, and I think it was the kind of thing that took a little bit of time to adjust to because a lot of people were accustomed to walking into a meeting to hear a leader talk at him or herself. But over time, people got used to the idea that they were actually expected to contribute and bring ideas, and I think one of the easiest ways to enhance that sense is actually to tell people why you invited them. You know, so often when I get invited to a meeting now, I actually ask, why did you decide to include me in this? And frequently, people don't have an answer. They say, well, I thought you might be interested in hearing what's going on. No, thank you. So I'd much rather give people a clear sense of, here is your unique contribution so that they can prepare.
So if they had said to you, Adam, that's because, you know, you've done some important research in motivation, and that's why we want to have you here?
That would be helpful.
That would be helpful. But would it be smart for a leader to say, if they're running a group, saying, you know what, I talk too much. I'm going to hold back, and I want to give you a chance to share your ideas about some of these projects that we're working on. I mean, to be that sort of out front and overt about what you're doing as a leader of a meeting.
I think it depends on how far overboard you've gone on talking. You know, there may be a point where it is necessary to call out that elephant in the room. if you're the person who's just been dominating the conversation for many, many months. But, you know, if it's just something where you feel like you're a little bit over the edge of what might be helpful, then, you know, I think it's reasonable to just propose a shift in format so that you can diversify the voices that are in the room.
I mean, some people talk a lot and some people are not big talkers. How do you pull someone out that you know has good ideas but is reluctant to share them?
Well, I think there are a couple ways to manage that. The first thing is to say this is a huge problem in brainstorming, probably more than in any other type of meeting. So you get together to brainstorm, and there's a lot of evidence showing that the loud, extroverted people tend to do most of the talking, and you miss out on really great ideas from introverts who are less motivated to steer the conversation and sometimes also have a harder time getting into it.
Sure.
The nice thing is that brainstorming research, we've got 40 years of it now, showing that on average, if you were to take five people and have them brainstorm together in a room, they will produce lower quality and lower quantity of ideas than those same five people locked in separate rooms. So what do you do with that? Well, one answer is to actually shift your model to brain writing, which is where you give the prompt or the question in advance, and you ask everybody to write down all the ideas they have, and then if getting people's voices heard is a problem, you actually submit those anonymously. And then everybody gets to see the full pool of ideas that's on the table.
Hmm.
And that allows you to really get all the individual contributions, and then the group can do what it does best, which is to evaluate and build and refine.
Well, and it's a very interesting example. Using that as an example, I would assume the group can then learn that this person that maybe doesn't talk a lot actually has some pretty good ideas?
Yeah, it's amazing how often that is true. To quote Susan Cain, the author of Quiet, there is zero correlation between who's the best talker and who has the best ideas.
So if you're running a meeting, I mean, does it make sense to call on people? If you know someone is sitting there and has something, do you call them out or you sort of let them go?
I think it depends on how critical you think their input is going to be and also how comfortable they'll be, you know, really being on the spot.
Right.
But we do have a lot of evidence for this idea of unearthing the silent minority. And sometimes it's quite critical, right, that the person who's not speaking up actually has unique information that the rest of the group needs to hear. Ideally, you preview in advance that you might be calling on them to give their perspective. But if worse comes to worse, I think it's reasonable to actually direct the microphone to that person and say, I'd really love to hear your thoughts on this particular issue.
Well, Adam, we're almost having a break here. I have to say the people in the control room are shaking, no, 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 you don't do that.
Well, I actually say that in part because there's a chilling case at NASA where a space shuttle was launched that ended up exploding because there were not people in the room who were willing to call out the individual who had the contrary information.
Wow.
And so sometimes it matters.
Indeed it does. And that's Adam Grant, again, a professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, wrote a book that came out earlier this year called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. And we asked him to join us today in Radio Times to help us understand how to run an efficient and effective meeting. We have Catherine Degas waiting in the wings from Google, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. On display now through December 31st, Capture the Moment, the Pulitzer Prize photographs, a comprehensive exhibition of Pulitzer Prize-winning photography. Information at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
As the calendar pages fall away and 2013 comes to an end, you might be thinking of how to get that last-minute tax deduction. Whether you make a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
Home birth sounds cozy. Your own room, a tub, or a candlelight, perhaps.
I wanted to be up moving. I wanted it to be as natural as possible.
But is it safe?
I don't think there's any question that home birth is dangerous.
I'm Mike and Scott. Next time on The Pulse, the fight over home birth.
Women are not getting accurate information.
And what role should midwives play?
We're not untrained. We're not witches.
The Pulse, Friday at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we're talking about how to run a good meeting in this hour of Radio Times. Again, Adam Grant, our guest for the full hour. And joining us now is Catherine Dekus. She's a people analytics manager at Google. And Catherine Dekus, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
What the heck is a people analytics manager?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I work in a group called People Analytics, and our mission is to make sure that all of our people decisions at Google are made based on data and analytics.
So real hardcore data.
Yeah, hardcore data. Lots of scientists and former academics in our group.
Well, we were doing some research on how to run a meeting and came across a couple of articles about Google and the fact that Google seems to do a better job than most in running a meeting. Is that, I know you work there, do you think that's true?
Yeah, you know, in listening to you over the past couple of minutes, I think it is true. I think it's a shame that meetings actually get such a bad rap, and I think we do a decent job at Google actually trying to make sure that they promote efficiency and collaboration as opposed to, you know, becoming a huge drain on people's time and morale.
So what does that look like?
So a lot of the things that I think you and Adam were just talking about, actually, so whether that means preparing a fair bit in advance of the meeting, you know, making sure that there is a clear owner and decision maker, that agendas are sent out in advance, and then, you know, during the meeting, making sure that you're moving toward a decision or a goal, right? And that if you're not, there's no shame in calling the meeting off, you know, and closing it down early or after the fact, you know, giving feedback to the person who owns the meeting and saying, I don't think that was really necessary or I think it could have been done better.
Adam, let me get you back in on the conversation. Does that sound like the characters or the characteristics of a good meeting?
It does, and I think Google is probably the only place where I've ever looked forward to having meetings.
Really? For the reasons that Catherine just laid out for us?
Very much so, and also because I think the steering assumption in most of the Google meetings that I've sat in on is that everybody's there to bring new and exciting ideas to the table, even when, you know, the topic is one that might be routine.
And does it, Catherine, are the meetings, I mean, relatively short at Google? And by that I mean, what, half an hour, 45 minutes, something like that?
Yeah, I would say on average there is a norm that by default a meeting should be 30 minutes unless it needs to be longer. And so most groups will default to that kind of short timeline.
Does that make sense, Adam, a 30-minute meeting?
It does, and I think especially if you take into account Google time where people might arrive 5 or 10 minutes late, it ends up delightfully short.
Well, let's talk about arriving late for a meeting. Catherine, how does that play at Google?
Yeah, on the whole, I would say that people are, they do tend to arrive sometimes a couple minutes late because, you know, they may be coming from a different building or a different meeting. On the whole, though, what we really try to do is start and end on time, particularly since a lot of people join via video conference. So we don't have everybody, you know, necessarily in person in the meeting. And so it's a shame to miss out on, you know, the voices from people who are not able to, you know, be in the room or hear the informal conversation before and after.
I mean, Adam, it seems to me that arriving on time, isn't that meeting etiquette 101?
Well, I think it is. I think at the same time, there are a lot of other priorities that people have in organizations, and there might be a moment when you're working on a task or you're in another meeting that might be more critical and has stretched a little bit long. And I think the real test of whether it's important for you to arrive on time then is, can the meeting proceed without you?
Mm. Oh, the idea is that you wouldn't disrupt that meeting by joining late?
That's right.
We got an email from a Shannon who said, I have a few minutes to listen to Adam Grant before running to the first of four meetings today, one of my better days for meetings. And Adam, let me toss that first to you. Four meetings in a day? Does that seem excessive? Yes.
Although I would say, you know, in general, people are better at serial processing than parallel processing. So if you do have to have a bunch of meetings, it may make sense to stack them all together in a day so that then you have a real chunk of time in a different day that's not interrupted constantly by meetings.
What do you think, Catherine?
I agree completely. I would say, though, that that's probably more the norm than the exception for people these days, particularly as you are leading a team or working across teams, and you need to schedule your time in some way to remain efficient. And so sometimes meetings are actually the best way to do that.
And do you have rules at Google about texting during meetings?
We don't have any formal rules, no. However, I mean, we know from research, and Adam certainly can weigh in more than I can on this one, but we know from research that people aren't very good multitaskers. And so to the extent that you really care about what's going on in the meeting and you want to show respect for the people in the meeting, we do tend to have a norm where texting or being on your laptop is sort of taboo.
And because what, people will frown at you or ask you to not do that, or is it more...
Sometimes you'll get called out, but more than likely you just get sort of shamed quietly later on when you don't know what's going on.
A very effective approach, if I must say so. Adam, how do you see texting, and should we have rules about texting during meetings?
Yeah, I think that the most effective meetings that I've been a part of have started with, assuming they've met some of the other criteria that we've talked about in the beginning of the show, then you start with actually taking your cell phone, your laptop, your iPad, whatever technology you have, and put it all out on the table, or even check it at the meeting door so that you know everyone's focused, and then you can use everyone's time respectfully and efficiently.
And you don't find people just staring at that pile of stuff.
Well, you have to put it far enough away that
they can't see
it.
I'm wondering too, Catherine, about just hiring the kinds of managers that know how to run meetings. How important is that?
I think it's a good thing to strive for, but certainly this is also something that can be trained or culturally, enforced, sort of. So to the extent that the culture really promotes and cares about efficiency and feedback and so forth, I think that you can certainly make this something that the group works on over time together.
Isn't there something called Project Oxygen at Google?
Yes, yes. So Project Oxygen was a study that we did about how to be a good people manager, and we give people 8 very clear behaviors about the things that they can do to improve their own people management skills, and then we actually assess managers on these behaviors as well. And one of them is keeping the team focused on the high-priority results and deliverables, and I would say that running a good meeting is a key part of keeping a team focused.
Does that make sense to you, Adam?
It does. I think it's something that we can teach every manager to do more effectively.
Because these are, relational skills. I mean, obviously keeping focus, but I would assume if you have a leader or a manager that doesn't particularly care about people, that's going to show up in a meeting, isn't it, Adam?
It often does, and I think that's where many managers really lose the trust and the respect of their team members.
Catherine, you agree?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think that you have to show people that you're respecting their time, right? And running a good meeting is one way of doing that.
And what about one-on-one meetings? We've been talking meetings as if they involve groups of people, but one-on-one meetings are also important as well. Catherine?
Yes, we highly encourage managers run one-on-one meetings with all of their team members at least weekly to the extent it makes sense for the project or the products that they're working on. And that's kind of a different situation. And again, it's important that someone own every meeting. And so often for a one-on-one meeting with your direct report, at least what I do is actually give ownership to the person I'm meeting with. And they own the meeting, they set the agenda, and if they don't feel like they want to meet in a given week, that's fine.
Oh, that's interesting. And do you find people do want to meet with you once they set the agenda every week?
Yeah, I would say in general, at least on my team, it's a norm that we tend to meet every week, and people tend to set the agendas accordingly. And sometimes it's just to update me about what's going on, sometimes to get my opinion on things and so forth, but it's a nice time to just set aside dedicated time to make sure that we're all on the same page. We can have a little check-in about how things are going.
What do you think about one-on-one meetings, Adam?
Well, I think this is the bright side of meetings. In many cases, there's a body of research that I love by Wayne Boss, who looks at probably the single most important decision that a manager makes, which is to meet with every single one of his or her direct reports at least twice a month, and finds that that's the easiest way to not only boost performance and satisfaction, but to also essentially build a stronger relationship with mm-hmm. your employees so that when it comes time to do a performance review or make a promotion decision, they know exactly where they stand and they really trust the decision that you're going to make.
And you like the idea that the not the boss, but the person that they're dealing with, that they set the agenda? Do you like that idea?
I do. I think it actually encourages them to seek out feedback and also to ask for help and support where they need it.
Well, Catherine Dekus, we have to say goodbye to you, and I thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's a people analytics manager at Google. And Adam Grant staying with us for the rest of the hour. Again, professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Wrote a book called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success that came out earlier this year. And a lot of his work has been focused on things like motivation and helping behaviors, job design, leadership burnout, meaningful work. And we asked him to join us today in Radio Times to talk about how to manage and run a good meeting. Let me get, looks like Bob from Northeast Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Bob, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a project manager, and thus my job is involved in creating meetings all the time. And one of the things I've noticed is I get high turnout rate on my meetings. I use what's called a PAL system, purpose, agenda, leader, and location mm-hmm. on every meeting so they know why they're coming to my meeting. And then I also publish the meeting results live as we're talking through the meeting on the agenda items using OneNote, so it goes out immediately. And the best book I've ever read about this, and I'm looking forward to reading your guest's book, the best book I've read so far about it is Death by Meetings.
Death by Meetings, right, a very appropriate title. Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Adam Grant, does that make sense to you?
It does, and I think some organizations have taken this to quite an extreme. I think of Bridgewater, the hedge fund, where they believe in radical transparency to the point that every meeting is videotaped and accessible to every employee in the company at any time.
Oh, wow. And does that mean that people then will behave better knowing they're on camera?
Well, it's an open question about whether at some point you just get used to it, sort of like we see on reality TV.
Right.
But
yes.
I think that, you know, at minimum what it does is it really reduces gossip that goes on behind people's backs. It, you know, it makes conversations a little bit more honest and less political. And it allows everyone to know what's going on whenever they feel like they need more information.
So rather than have a meeting about everything, you've got this sort of constant stream of information coming out.
That's right.
Let me get, looks like Carolyn from Northern Maryland to join our conversation. Hey, Carolyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Adam, you had mentioned earlier in the conversation where you send out agendas ahead of time and you send out questions for brainstorming ahead of time, which is something that I've practiced in my previous role as a project manager. But in today's society, we have, you know, we're so busy, we're running from one meeting to the next, and we don't have time to really focus and flow to sit down and do that work. So I was wondering if you could have any recommendations on how to manage that.
Caroline, you're talking about the kind of information overload that we often feel?
Right, and we're so rushed, you know, in corporate America these days to get everything done, and we're running from one meeting to the next, and, you know, we have lives outside of our jobs,
sure.
Obviously. So how do you manage to that? How do you have people, you know, sit down and look at the agenda ahead of time and come prepared to the meeting, come prepared with their brainstorming questions, as you had talked about earlier?
It's a good question. Carolyn, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Adam Grant, can you help her out?
I wish I had an easy answer to that question. I'll say that one of the simplest things that you could do, at least to make a little bit of progress, is to take the first few minutes of the meeting and give people a chance to do some individual brain writing. I had a chance to experiment with this. We, again, have a lot of research evidence for it, but I wanted to see how does it play out in real life. So I was running a nonprofit board meeting not too long ago, and everybody came together, very, very busy group of people, lots of other priorities, and they showed up, and it was very clear that everybody was well-intentioned, but nobody had done their homework.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, let's take a step back. I'd just like to set aside 8 to 10 minutes. Here's the question. I want everybody to write down all their ideas, and then we'll go around the room and hear all the ideas, and then we'll use that to begin to drive the conversation moving forward, and that was immensely helpful.
In what way? What happened to that meeting?
Well, first of all, there were a number of people who spoke up that normally didn't, and we got to hear more creative and diverse ideas than we usually would. The second thing that happened was we were able to see that there were a bunch of ideas that everybody was thinking about. Mm. And we didn't need to spend a huge amount of time on those because there was already consensus. And that allowed us to clear out more space to really focus on the ideas that didn't have a lot of support so we could figure out whether they were worth pursuing or not.
We are talking about how to run a meeting in this hour of Radio Times. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions, comments, or stories that you want to tell us, do give us a call. Again, 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Adam, let me get, looks like Jody from Bala Cynwyd to join our conversation. And Jody, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I am retired now, but I have to confess, I used to like meetings. I liked the group camaraderie. I felt like if there was some sort of party at work, people would stand around like bumps on a log unless there was liquor. But at meetings, people would quickly share information back and forth. And just the way in today's times, you still have parties. People just don't Skype back and forth to each other.
Right.
So could you talk about that? Isn't there room for just kind of getting together with folks who may have different schedules, maybe stuck in cubicles most of the day?
Jody, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Sounds like a helicopter behind her. Adam Grant, what do you think of Jody's comment?
What a refreshing view.
Yes, indeed.
I can't remember the last time I met someone who liked meetings, and I think, Jody, you were really lucky to clearly have a group of colleagues that were fun to be around and that also made meetings a source of community, not just a reason to be bored and frustrated. I think that goes back to our initial discussion of what is the purpose of the meeting.
Right.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to bring people together and say, look, we're having this meeting as a team-building event or for the purpose of bonding. And if everybody knows that's the expectation at the outset, it's a lot easier to enjoy it and to not feel like it's inefficient because, of course, the goal then isn't efficiency. One of my favorite examples of that is an exercise that comes out of the Humax Corporation called the Reciprocity Ring, where you bring a group of people together for what looks like a meeting. It could be 8 to 10 people, could be several dozen. But you ask everybody to make a request for something they want or need but cannot get on their own. And then you challenge the rest of the group to try to use their knowledge and their networks to help fulfill the request. And it turns out to be a really fun way of allowing people to get to know each other. You know, what is everybody trying to accomplish? What kinds of resources do people have that I didn't realize? And you walk away with a pretty good sense that you were able to help out a lot of people.
And we're almost up at a break here, but Adam, just picking up on that, I mean, does it also tell us that even people that we work with every day, we might not know them as well as we think we do?
Yeah, it's remarkable to see what kinds of requests come out and also the ways that people are able to help. In one case, I actually saw a manager and a direct report who'd worked together for 17 years. And the manager had a request, and the direct report said, I've got a way to help out with this. And they had no idea that they could actually connect that way.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking about how to manage and run a good meeting. What is a good meeting? A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. And again, Adam Grant, our guest. He's a professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents David Sedaris' The Santaland Diaries, adapted by Joe Mantello, now through December 23rd. For 10 years running, Flashpoint's Santaland Diaries brings Sedaris' lovable curmudgeonly Crumpet, the Macy's elf, to life, making audiences laugh until they cry. Flashpoint Theater is located on Sansom Street, 2 blocks from the Avenue of the Arts. For tickets, 267-997-3312 or flashpointtheater.org.
British actor Michael Sheen played David Frost in the film Frost Nixon and Prime Minister Tony Blair in The Queen and 2 other films. On the next Fresh Air, Sheen talks about those roles and playing sex researcher William Masters.
We are doctors, and I simply want to answer the question, what happens to the body during sex?
Sheen stars in the Showtime series Masters of Sex. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
awesome ride, dude.
It doesn't go fast. It's not racy in any sense. But every corner of this car has memories for me.
From Detroit to Tehran, a man who designed Chryslers falls back in love with the wheels of his younger days. No GTO, Iran's humble Paycon gets respect. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Boy, I wish we could have more meetings. I wish that meeting could have gone on even longer. These are things you generally don't hear at work. Adam Grant, our guest, says it's possible to run a good and effective meeting that people actually enjoy. He wrote a book earlier this year called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do give us a call. Adam, what do you think about PowerPoint? Do we have Adam? Go ahead, Adam.
It depends on the purpose, of course, but I'm often reminded of Edward Tufte's observation in his book Visual Explanations that PowerPoint has the capacity to make all of us a little bit dumber. It often conceals important information, but look, I think it can be a useful way to engage an audience and to summarize or simplify a point.
I've been, though, to meetings where they've used PowerPoint, and it tends to be sort of reading along what's on the PowerPoint presentation. I've never quite understood what is the point of PowerPoint.
Well, I think that would be a poorly designed PowerPoint, then. I think that my rule when creating slides is that they should have as few words as possible, and in many cases, no words, so that what's being said is actually original in some way, and the slides actually support and enhance it.
So pictures, I mean, visuals, things like that.
Exactly.
How do you suggest dealing with, let's say, conflict within a meeting, and that stuff happens?
Yeah, I think one of the things that a lot of people overlook is that not all conflict is bad. There's research that's been, for me, very enlightening on this by Eddie Jen and her colleagues on three different types of conflict that can happen during meetings. So we have relationship conflict, which is basically the I hate your guts and I wish you didn't exist kind of personal, emotional clash. And that turns out to be destructive in meetings and in groups more generally. But these other two kinds of conflict, although sometimes people react negatively to them, are useful and can be constructive. One is task conflict, where we disagree about the vision or the goal or the strategy. And then procedural conflict is where we have some kind of debate about how we're going to get our work done or how we're going to delegate roles or even just when we're going to meet. And sometimes we need dissent around tasks and processes in order to come to the best decision.
But what about the resentments that sometimes happen at work? I mean, is there a way to handle those? This is the more emotional side, but ways of handling those if they come up in a meeting?
Yeah, my favorite resource on this is the book Difficult Conversations by Stone, Patton, and Heen. They walk through a series of steps that I think are quite valuable, and one of those is what is often called walking down the ladder of inference, where when people get into conflict and it becomes relationship-based and emotional, it's often because they're arguing only about conclusions without actually explaining, here are the data or the experience or the observations that led me to those conclusions. And as they start to unpack their thought processes, they can often have an easier time getting on the same page.
Interesting. What about we talked about leaders that talk too much, but sometimes there are meetings where there's one person that really dominates the conversation to the point where one can sometimes feel within the meeting the sort of moaning and groaning of everyone else there. How do you deal with that?
I would be...
You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
I was in one of those meetings this week, in fact.
Were you really? And how do you deal with that?
Well, I think there are multiple ways to think about it. I think in this case, what we ended up doing was appointed the person who knew the offender best. And, they had sort of a one-on-one side conversation where where our appointed delegate said, I've heard from a lot of people that they're frustrated by how much you're dominating the conversation. And, I think it's really important that everybody has a chance to get their voice heard. So is there anything we can do to facilitate that happening? Not an easy conversation,
but
I think in some cases important.
Did you know what this person said in response?
The response was that this person was not aware of how much airtime was being commanded and was quite sheepish.
Interesting. We got an email from Simon. Is it better to have a meeting in the morning, say around 10 o'clock, than in the afternoon because of the differences of in brain function? Have you looked at that, Adam?
You know, I haven't personally, but there is some research on this in the United Kingdom by Peter Totterdell. And he finds that it actually varies a lot by person because, you know, there's obviously a difference between people in circadian rhythms. And so whether, you know, a morning meeting is good for one person or an afternoon meeting is better for another person is really hard to say.
Hmm. Let me get Sanjeev from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. Sanjeev, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I've worked for several corporations at their headquarters all over the country. And most recently, I was working at Sunoco. And what I found there was the first time my boss there, Paul Pinter, had introduced me to working with our teammates on things that we needed to get done. It was our individual responsibilities. And then since I've left Sunoco for in the last 10 years being on my own, what I found has made a lot of progress is we'll have meetings during the week with 3-4 people at the most. They're scheduled half hour to an hour at the most. And we actually work on the tasks that individually we're responsible to do, but we're not being diverted or distracted or phones. And it's been incredibly productive.
Sanjeev, that's interesting. Let me see what Adam Grant has to say in response. Makes sense to you, Adam?
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. I think it's something I would love to see more organizations thinking about. And, you know, I think there are ways to actually help more leaders and team members learn from what's working and not working in meetings. Mm. One approach that I think is creating a lot of buzz right now comes out of the MIT Media Lab from Sandy Petland, who has these sociometric badges that actually keep track in a meeting who's talking,
their
tone, so how are they coming across, their body position, and their body language, so that you can actually read the mood of a group and then figure out, okay, what's the energy like? How engaged are people? Is there enough exploration of different people or different ideas? And I think that can be a really useful way to learn.
Indeed. Sanjeev, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you talked about short meetings with small groups of people. Is that an effective way, a smart way to go, Adam?
I think so. I think that, you know, in general, most organizations err on the side of having too many people in the room because they're trying to be inclusive.
Right.
And make sure that everybody feels like they're being welcomed and they have a chance to participate. And I would rather see, you know, groups have a representative who attends the meeting and then reports back or summarizes.
I'm looking at something from the Wall Street Journal, looking at a CEO breaking down a CEO's time in a 55-hour work week. On average, 18 hours out of the week spent in meetings. I think that's about a third of the time. Does that make sense to you, Adam? Is that pretty typical, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. There's, of course, fluctuation from one industry to another, but I think across the board that's consistent with what I've seen.
And is that a good thing, a bad thing? I mean, obviously it depends on what's happening in these meetings.
Yeah, I mean, the data, Steve Rogelberg and his colleagues have tracked meeting satisfaction across organizations and industries, and they do find that most people are pretty dissatisfied with their meetings and the amount of time they spend in them. I've worked with some managers who have set a goal of cutting meeting time in half on a weekly basis. And I think that's probably something that's worth trying in many organizations to see whether, you know, you can get the same information exchanged and the same high-quality decision made without necessarily spending that much time in meetings.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have, I can't read the whole name here, Professor, looks like Larry, somebody or other, from Ambler. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
My question is about, the managers sometimes feel obliged to hold meetings and they have no intention of listening to anybody or making any decisions. How do you deal with that?
Go ahead, Adam.
Well, I'll throw out one of my favorite suggestions here. For anyone who's interested in more details, I wrote about this in Chapter 5 of Give and Take. I would actually go to that manager and ask for advice. So I might sit down with the manager and say, you know, I'm trying to figure out how I can contribute more usefully in meetings, and, you know, I know you have a lot of experience in meetings. Would you be willing to share some of your wisdom with me? And three things will tend to happen when you have that conversation. The first is you flatter your manager by, you know, showing that you really care about his or her advice. If I can paraphrase Benjamin Franklin for a moment, we all admire the wisdom of people who come to us for advice. Because let's face it, they have really good taste, right, Marty?
Indeed, they do.
So then, you know, your manager's feeling good that, you know, that you valued that wisdom. And to answer the question, has to do a little bit of perspective taking and walk in your shoes, which means, you know, they're going to think a little bit about, mm-hmm. okay, you know, what would make this meeting a little bit more productive or more effective, and how could you add value? And then, you know, best case scenario, the manager becomes your advocate and actually makes a change to the meeting structure or process. Worst case scenario, you at least get a few ideas, and then, sure. you know, when you speak up and try to change the meeting, your manager sort of seeded those ideas and is maybe more open to supporting them.
I appreciate that call to Radio Times. Is it also important, Adam, what happens after a meeting and whether that's the criteria, whether a meeting has been successful enough, what has been accomplished, and then what happens next?
Yeah, I think one of the best practices that, again, many organizations are moving toward, but I'd like to see even more doing it, is an after-action review, where you take the last couple of minutes of a meeting or the very beginning of a next meeting and review what worked in this meeting and what do we want to change next time, which I think is one of the best ways to consolidate effective practices and fix things that are broken.
Let me get, looks like Allison from Bryn Mawr to join our conversation. Allison, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Hey, my comment is related actually not to a professional board, but a volunteer board. I'm a member of a volunteer board where obviously the structure is a little different because you don't have technically managers and employees, and everyone's there because they want to help. But mm-hmm. you end up encountering, I think, some of the same problems. And one of the things that sort of caught my ear was, you know, you have one member of your meeting that's dominating the meeting and is, you know, unwilling to allow things to move forward unless it's in the way that they prefer it to be moving forward. So I wondered if your guest had any suggestions mm-hmm. for how to work on that kind of a situation when you don't have a managerial or, you know, as strict of an employee-manager structure in place. It's really like herding cats, kind of.
I hear you, and it's a great question. Adam, do you want to respond to Allison's question?
I'll take a stab at it. I think the first step for me in trying to navigate a situation like that is to begin to understand the motivation of the person who's dominating the conversation. Excuse me. Is it that, you know, this person really enjoys hearing him or herself talk? If so, then yeah, my response to that is to try to create other settings in which that person's voice can be heard a little bit more and hope that he or she runs out of air by the time we get to the meeting. No, but I think, you know, there are other motivations for speaking often, right? One is insecurity and wanting to make sure that people know you are an expert in a particular area or that you're passionate about a topic. And one of the easiest ways then to curb that kind of behavior is to actually affirm that person's contribution and say, look, you know, I know that this person has done, you know, some important work in this area or has a valuable perspective to bring, and so I've carved out 5 or 10 minutes in the meeting agenda for this person to speak. And then you at least try to consolidate, you know, the time that they take up into a key window and then allow other people to participate the rest of the time.
Allison, good luck with that, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Adam, do you think it's different if it is a volunteer board, as Allison was describing, versus a workplace? Are there different dynamics when it comes to having a meeting?
Yeah, there can be. Mark Snyder and colleagues have shown that people often bring very different motivations to volunteer roles than they do to their workplaces. And so, I think it is worth recognizing that when you walk into, you know, a meeting in a volunteering setting, it's possible that people are a little bit more focused in that setting on how can I help and what is, you know, my value added going to be, which sometimes can be complicated even though it may be well-intentioned. You will also find that a lot of people do sign up to volunteer to substitute for things that are missing in their work. So if you have people who feel like, you know, they haven't risen to the position that they wanted in their professional careers, they'll often seek out some kind of nonprofit role as a way to compensate for that. And, you know, that's where I think validation seeking becomes especially common.
Do you think a meeting is a place for truth-telling? And by that, I mean dealing with that so-called elephant in the room, the thing that no one wants to talk about?
I think it can be, and I think that's where, as a leader, one of the things that's worth doing is actually preparing one or two people in advance if you're going to have a conversation like that.
Right.
There's an example that I'm fond of from Tom Garrity, who used to be the dean of the Wharton School. And Tom was running an organization a couple decades ago, actually, where he felt like there wasn't enough clear communication, and a lot of people were not giving feedback. So he called an all-staff meeting. Over 100 people in total show up for this event, and he stands up and opens himself up to criticism and invites everybody in the company to tell him what he's doing wrong.
Wow.
And he had to prepare a consultant and a colleague to say, look, I'm going to do this, and I need you to really speak candidly so that other people are willing to do that. And I think what Tom recognized was when he role modeled that behavior, then in future meetings, other people were willing to call out that elephant in the room.
Mm. Do you call that good leadership?
I do. I do. I think it was remarkably effective if you look at the results that he produced.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, and I appreciate the fact that I can hear you. I know you have a really bad cold, so I appreciate the fact that you joined us, Adam. Is email a substitute for meetings?
It's a substitute for unnecessary and useless meetings. But it's not a substitute for meetings that are actually going to be about combining different perspectives and reaching a decision. Because, in general, people don't share nearly as much information on email as they do when they meet face-to-face or by phone, and you lose the opportunity to actually learn about the ideas and the data behind some of the opinions that people are expressing. So I think there is a time and a place to say, look, we've got to take this off email and come together and talk.
Do you know everything?
No.
No, and I ask you that because you know, we're just talking about meetings, and you have quoted probably a dozen studies within this hour, Adam.
That's in the job description, right? This is what you do when you're a kid who likes memorizing stats on
baseball
cards.
That's great. No, it's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and good luck with that cold.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Adam Grant, professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Again, was a guest earlier this year on his most recent book called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.